Welcome to the 18th episode of A Change is a Chance. My name is Ryan Lowe, and it is my goal to educate as many people as possible by interviewing experts who can share their unique perspectives and inspire us to put our ideas into action to make a difference. First of all, I am beyond ecstatic to welcome everyone to the first A Change is a Chance episode of 2022. 2022 is going to be a big year of unknowns. We've got these election midterms. We are reaching 2 full years of COVID with new medications waiting to be approved. And there are many new legislations on the line. So what better way to kick off the new year than to welcome today's multi-talented, comedic, inspiring change maker, Mr. Brian Copeland.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, I welcome you to A Change is a Chance. How are you doing today?
I am doing just great. And I'm healthy. I don't have Omicron, so I just got a negative test, so I'm doing just great.
Good. So I am now going to try to give you a proper introduction. So please tell me if I missed anything.
Okay.
For many in the Bay Area, Mr. Copeland is a familiar name. He is an actor in movies Venom, Let There Be Carnage, and The Bucket List. He is the host of the podcast, Copeland's Corner, and host of the radio show KGO Newstalk 810. He is a comedian with shows Not a Genuine Black Man and The Waiting Period, and author of books Not a Genuine Black Man, The Jewelry Box, and The Waiting Period. So how is that?
That's great. That's a great intro. You did your homework. Thank you.
So most people like to end with predictions, but I think with you, I am going to start with them.
Okay.
Earlier, I mentioned 2022 being a big year. First of all, do you agree with that?
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. For a couple of reasons. You mentioned the midterms, and depending on what happens in November, we are potentially going to see drastic changes in the direction of this country if Congress switches parties, if the Republicans take over the majority, there will be a different approach to how we deal with COVID, how we deal with taxes, how we deal with the social safety net, all kinds of things. So that's one thing. And the other thing is what's going to happen with COVID. Is this the year that COVID finally, although it's not expected to fully go away, but the pandemic at some point will end. Is this the year the pandemic ends? Is Omicron the last gasp of COVID, or are we looking at something else? Are we looking at another variant before December 31st?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, we're just using Greek alphabet. So is the Omega variant next?
Yeah, I think that is the next one, if there's another one.
I hope there isn't.
Yeah, you and me both, pal.
So I met you through Miss Amy Glynn. Most people aren't going to know who that is. Mm-hmm. And since then, I've been trying to learn about you. And through that, with that on the line, here are some questions that I wanted to ask you.
Okay, go ahead.
First of all, I read your book, Not a Genuine Black Man.
Well, thank you.
It was really emotional, touching, personal, and funny. From being singled out as the black kid in town, experiencing intentional and unintentional racism, to then receiving the anonymous letter saying that you are not a genuine black man. Who do you think you are today? And what is the message that you want to share with others about ethnic identity?
I think I am today as someone who's very comfortable with in my own skin. It was a long time before I was comfortable in my own skin. What the book details is my growing up in San Leandro, California, in the East Bay, right next door to Oakland, at a time when it was, depending on whose numbers you believe, 95% to 99.9% white. And as a result of that, you know, being the square peg in, you know, with the round holes, so to speak, I had a real difficult time with identity. As I've gotten older, I have come to terms with that through at some point some very painful processes in order to get there. If there were a message, and I never really meant to send a message, you know, with any of my work, I don't try to, I just say what it is that I think or write what it is that I feel. The book Genuine is based on a one-man play of the same name, Not a Genuine Black Man, that went on to be the longest running solo show in the history of Bay Area theater. It was supposed to run for 6 weeks, and that's how I ended up writing a book about it. There's just a couple, in that play was just some stuff I had to get off my chest. So I don't really try to send messages, but if I were going to say that there is a theme, the theme to that whole story would be that nobody has the right to determine who you are except for you. You know, you determine who it is that you are. It doesn't matter what anybody else says.
Yeah, I agree. It's true. There is no accurate label of a different person. Like for me, I do not feel that Asian American or American is a proper version of who I am. Mm-hmm. So I'm still trying to figure out who I am.
Yeah, when I was your age, it was exactly the same. I was in exactly the same, you know, place. You know, I was, when I was in the eighth grade, and you know, I went to Catholic school, and there were 40 of us, and it was 39 white kids and me. And I, you know, and I just, you know, I never fully felt like I fit in. You know, I never fully felt like I fit in.
Do you still live in San Leandro with your family?
In fact, I do. I still live here. Mm-hmm. It's a much different town now. As of the 2010 census, it's one of the most diverse suburbs in America. I don't know what the 2020 census says yet, but according to the 2010 census, the demographics closely mirror the demographics of America in terms of the number of whites, the number of blacks, the number of Latinos, the number of Asians, and so forth. So it's a very different town now than the one I grew up in.
In your book, you also talk about a time when your son said to you that someone at school told him that brown people are bad. Yeah. Well, I may not be old enough for that. I would feel shattered and anguished if my own child heard something like that at school. So what do you say as a parent in this situation?
Well, he was at preschool, actually, at the time. He was 4 years old. And it made me sick is what it did, because this is a four-year-old, you know, which means that he picked this up from an ignorant adult. That's the only way to put it, from an ignorant adult. I believe my son has said at the time that his friend's daddy had told him that brown people were bad. And I had to explain to him, to the best of his ability to comprehend at the age of four, that there are good people and there are bad people of all pigmentation, you know, in this world. And the color of one's skin is not indicative of one's character.
Yeah. First of all, how old is your son now?
And now he's 32 now. So this happened a long time ago.
Does he still remember this? Or...
No, it's funny. I haven't asked him if he remembered it. You know, he's of course read the book and he's seen the play a number of times, but I don't know. I have not asked him if he actually remembers that or not. That's a good question. I'll have to ask him. Do you remember us having that conversation? We were in the car, you know, and he was sitting in the back seat in a car seat actually, and. When we were coming from a hobby shop, and at the hobby shop there was a dollhouse at the cash register, at the checkout register, and they had families in furniture and things for the dollhouse, and the families of dolls, one was white and one was black, one was African American, and that's on the ride home when he asked if I was going to get one for his little sister. His little sister was two at the time. And he said that if I did, to get the white family, not the brown family, because brown people were bad. So that was the context of that whole conversation. And the way that we dealt with it was his mother and I tried to explain to him to the best of his comprehension. And then, you know, long before Forrest Gump, I got a box long before Forrest Gump was in the popular culture. I got a box of chocolates and spread them out and cut them open to show that while they all looked the same on the outside, they were all different on the inside. And I think that the fact that he was able to eat candy helped. made sure he was listening to me because he was able to eat candy. But I think that the message got through at that point.
Well, that was a pretty smart way to show it to him.
Yeah, I think it was effective. I think it was effective.
So now let's talk about your career. You are a renowned actor, playwright, comedian, radio talk show host, and author. Which one of these has been the most meaningful to you? And which one do you think most defines who you are?
Well, everything that I do really comes from writing. That's really the basis of everything that is that I do. I ended up in television. I started as a stand-up and, I had to write material in order to get on the stage and perform it. I ended up on television because I used to write commentaries. I would write funny commentaries. And I did them for radio, then I did them for television, and then I got offered hosting jobs as a result of that. I've written books, I write plays, I'm writing a television series pilot right now. So really everything I do, the basis of it really comes from ground zero is putting pen to paper or sitting in front of my laptop.
Can you tell me a little bit about this pilot episode?
It's based. I'm really not at liberty to go into detail about it, but I can tell you that it's based on Not a Genuine Black Man. I can tell you that.
Ooh.
I can tell you that much.
Do you know when that's airing? Because I would love to watch that.
Well, I can't go into any more detail at this point right now.
Okay. Reasonable. So because you've had all these different roles, I think my listeners and I would want to hear your take on some of the pressing issues today, since you have some perspectives.
Okay.
So first up, let's talk about critical race theory. Earlier this year, Governor Gavin Newsom of California passed a law to require ethnic studies for high school graduation starting with the academic year of 2025. However, that is only in high school. What are your general opinions on teaching elementary school and middle school students the truth about the founding and creation of this nation? And how urgent should this matter be?
I can put it quite simply. You know who Ruby Bridges is? Are you familiar with Ruby Bridges? Ruby Bridges was a six-year-old girl who in the early 1960s had to have federal marshals walk her to class because she was among the first African-American children to integrate in all-white school. And she had to walk through crowds of adults, of parents who were cussing at her and yelling at her and spitting at her and screaming the N-word at her. And so in order for her to get to class, federal marshals had to walk her through. She has since, this was when she was 6 years old in the 60s, and there's a very famous painting by Norman Rockwell of her being escorted to school. She has since written a children's book about that experience. It's a children's picture book for elementary school kids. And it's just in the over the course of the last 6-8 months that you have seen her book become a part of the culture war that conservatives are trying to wage in this country, and saying that it was inappropriate for schools to have it. In fact, some schools have actually banned it. And I saw a meme that totally sums up, everything that you asked me about critical race theory, or whether or not kids are old enough in elementary school to learn these things. And that is, if it's 6 years old, she was old enough to survive it, then your kids are old enough to know about it.
Yeah. I feel like I would have wanted to learn the non-whitewashed narrative, including things like the massacre of the first people, mm-hmm. racism as a whole, and the contribution of immigrants way early on.
Sure. We were told most of what I was taught, in school, was not true. Or was the whitewash version of history. George Washington never chopped down that cherry tree story about, "Father, I cannot tell a lie." That never happened. He didn't have wooden teeth. The things that we were learning, Columbus, here. And when you find out what he did to the indigenous people, there's a great book by Howard Zinn that I would recommend to you, by Howard Zinn, called The People's History of the United States, or The People's History of America. One of the two is the title of this book, by Howard Zinn, Zinn. And he tells American history perspective of the people who were not in the dominant caste. That's the best way to put it.
Okay. Yeah, I'll check that out. So let's move on to voter suppression and gerrymandering. I had a previous guest from the U.S. Vote Foundation to talk about this, and I learned about the efforts to redistrict to keep certain leaders and ideologies in power. The right to vote is more vulnerable than ever for some. What can be done to stop voter suppression when many don't even know that their right to vote or their worth of their ballot is taken away?
Well, real simple. What can be done is that a new Voting Rights Act can be bill can be voted on in Congress, and the John Lewis Voting Act can be passed. And both of those things are not going to happen with any kind of Republican support in a 50-50 Congress, because the gerrymandering and all of these tricks are tricks to keep Republicans in power. The people whose votes are being denied are people who are less likely to vote Republican. That's why they have done things such as in Georgia, where you had 8 polling places in a district that's primarily African American. They're taking away 7 of the 8. That's why there is such a disparity in some parts of the country, primarily places in the South, where a white person can vote within an hour, but an African-American person or a person of color will have to wait 6 or 8 hours to vote. The reason being is because there are fewer polling places. So the only way we're going to do this is with federal action. And I think that it is a real failure of our system that you have basically one man in Joe Manchin, senator from West Virginia, who represents a minority of people holding this entire country's democracy hostage. He's the one that will not allow a change in the filibuster rule that would allow prohibit the filibuster from being used to filibuster voting rights legislation. If he would go along with that, then they could have a straight up or down vote, and you'd have 50 Democrats who would vote for voting rights, and 50 Republicans against, and Kamala Harris, being the Democratic vice president and president of the Senate, would vote with the Democrats. You'd have 51 votes, and we'd have voting rights legislation. But there is no incentive for this Republican Party. And I say this Republican Party because historically and traditionally, voting rights legislation has been mostly bipartisan. If you look at reauthorizations of the Voting Rights Act since 1965, you've had Democrats and Republicans pass it with no problem. They all agreed that voting is the critical part of our democracy, and they voted together. Now with this Republican Party, if you are not with them, you're the enemy. And so we are living under minority rule, which is not the way that America is supposed to work. It's supposed to be majority rules with minority rights. It's not supposed to be minority rule. But that's the thing that can be done to take care of voting rights. As far as gerrymandering is concerned, there needs to be federal action as well, and that new districts should be drawn up by a non-political, bipartisan commission in each state should be drawing up the districts. That's how it should be done. It should not be a partisan thing.
Yeah. And it's the selfishness and these scary tricks that are scaring everyone about the midterms this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it, is the fact that, it's just crazy. If you look at the number of people who have voted, we have a 50-50 Senate, okay? We have 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans in the United States Senate. If you look at the number of total votes, the total number of people who voted for Democrats far, by millions of votes, surpasses the number of people who voted for Republicans, yet they have the same equal representation in terms of numbers. And that's just not right. You know, if they want a Republican majority in this country, the way to do that should not be with dirty tricks to disenfranchise people. It should be by coming up with better ideas to convince people that to give them an opportunity to lead because they like their ideas. And the Electoral College needs to go for that very same reason. You know, the Electoral College, it's ludicrous that Hillary Clinton had 3 million more votes than Donald Trump, but Donald Trump ended up becoming president, because of a minority of the voters in the right states gave him the Electoral College. Joe Biden won by 7 million more votes than Donald Trump did. But that is not reflected in the Electoral College count. And that's only going to happen by a constitutional change, and you're never going to see a constitutional change because you need 3/5, I think it's 2/3, I believe it is, of the states that would have to ratify an amendment to the Constitution. And you'll never get 2/3 of the states to do that, to agree on that.
Yeah, well, there is no doubt that systems of the Constitutional Convention that were made there are a bit flawed today.
Yes. Yes, they are. Yes, they are. And I'm one of those people who believes that the Constitution is a living, breathing document. I'm not one of those people who believes that it's etched in stone and what it was that was written at the original Constitutional Convention in the 18th century should be taken word for word verbatim today in exactly the same meaning that the founders had when they created the document. Because the world in this nation has changed quite a bit over the course of the last 300 years.
I know, exactly. I mean, it definitely should be changed because it should evolve while this country is evolving with it.
I mean, if we're going to look at it, you know, you have those who call themselves strict constitutionalists, you know, people like the late Justice Antonin Scalia. You know, and who believe that it's not a living, breathing document, that you have to take it literally as it was meant. That, well, if you never changed it and you took it literally, then as an African-American, I'm only 3/5 of a person.
Oh, yeah, the 3/5 compromise.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I read Ibram X. Kendi's book on how to be an anti-racist. It talks about reevaluating one's perspective on race and what one has learned about it. It talks about owning responsibilities and biases and relearning race and racism. And I agree with what he says. And I do not think a lot of people want to admit that they have this racist thinking. Robin DiAngelo calls that white fragility. But honestly, it does apply to all races. How can we make everyone really rethink racial identities?
And I want to recommend another book right along that, with the two that you mentioned, and that would be Past by Isabel Wilkerson, which is, I have read it in the last 6 months, and it is probably, and this is not, I'm not being hyperbolic when I say this, it is probably the most important book I've ever read. Past, where she compares America's caste system to the caste system that exists in India. And we do have a caste system in this country. And the way that we, I don't know that we're ever gonna address what used to be called the race question in a way that is equitable for everyone. I believe that everyone has race biases, you know, be you black, white, you know, green or purple. We all have, some are conscious, some are unconscious. And what we have to do is call ourselves out on the biases, on our own biases, the ones that we have, or the ones that we don't realize that we have until we really think about, you know, how we look at other people and what stereotypes we harbor that we don't realize that we harbor until we say something or think something, and we have to, you know, stop and go, whoa, hang on a second, that's not right. That's a racial bias. That's something I've got to work on. But I think I think that's something that is endemic of everyone. We've all got biases.
Yeah. By the same coin, people always never will admit they're wrong, especially in these big places, because you can go on the internet, basically the big thing, yeah, and find your version of the truth wherever you go.
You don't have to go on the internet. You don't have to go on the internet to do it. You can do it on, you know, cable, yeah, news. We have an entire news cable. We have an entire cable news, and I'll put news in quotes, network that is dedicated to spreading the propaganda and perpetuating one version of the truth. You can, and it's not the truth, but you can find a quote unquote truth that you agree with based upon what newspapers you decide to read, what television news or information source you decide to go to. And that's not the way it used to be. You know, we need to do in this country, when I was your age, there was a thing in broadcasting that was called the Fairness Doctrine. And what the Fairness Doctrine was that if I came on and I gave a commentary on why sparkling water is terrible, then equal time had to be given to someone who disagreed with that point of view. And that kept things balanced. But once the equal time rule went away, that's when we ended up with this fractured system of information we have in this country, where there are quote unquote alternative truths and alternative facts.
A fact is a fact. You can't have another fact that's the exact opposite of that and both be exactly true. So exactly. Do you have any ideas on how now we can break this cycle of misinformation?
We are so fractured right now. I'll be totally honest with you. I don't know how we do it. I really don't know how we do it. As long as you've got a Fox News, as long as you've got an internet that is unregulated, and there's no way to regulate it, especially since it crosses international borders, where people can post whatever they want. And, you know, you have people. I read a thing yesterday, something I read an article about something that's being circulated on the internet that anti-vaxxers are clinging to now, that they believe that you can cure COVID without a vaccine. You can do it by drinking your own urine. That if you drink your own urine. So let me get this straight. Rather than a 2-second pinprick in your arm that is effective, okay, that's gonna protect you, drinking your own, you'd rather drink a glass of your own urine in order to protect you from COVID. I mean, so as long as there are people out there who are gonna post this kind of nonsense, and there are people who are gonna believe this kind of nonsense, what are you gonna do? How are you possibly going to break this cycle? I just don't see how we do it. Unfortunately, I'm just about out of time. So is there one thing you wanted to wrap up with?
Well, I was going to ask you what your next big project is. Is there anything you're allowed to share with us?
Other than the TV pilot I'm working on, that's really the next big project. And I have a new solo show about single parenting called Grandma and Me that's scheduled to open in San Francisco in April. It was supposed to open last April, but we were shut down. So I don't know if we're going to open this April or not. Depends on what Omicron does.
Well then, to all my listeners, I hope you have enjoyed getting to know Mr. Copeland as much as I have, and I hope that we all have enjoyed hearing his perspective on voter suppression, on this cycle of misinformation and critical race theory. So let's all hope that 2022 will bring us Well, something happy. It'll bring up something happy.
I'll go with that. Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. I'd love to come back again.
See you soon then, Mr. Copeland.
All right.
Bye. Happy New Year.
Bye.
So that's it for A Change of the Chance, episode 18. I hope you have learned something, and I'll see you in the next episode.